You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 10th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hello, hello.
And Evan Bernstein.
As we wished a happy birthday to Arthur Holly Compton, born this day in 1892.
Compton in the house.
The Compton effect.
Yeah, that's I love that album.
He's a Nobel laureate in physics for his discovery of the Compton effect.
Which is the
decrease in energy of X-ray and gamma ray photons as it interacts with matter. Of course.
Of course.
Not just a Graydon Square album.
And, of course, tomorrow is the seven-year anniversary of 9/11.
Way to bring it down, Steve.
Well, you know, how could we not mention 9/11 on 9/10?
Oh, good point.
What were you guys doing at the moment you found out about it?
Oh, no. Do we have to go into that?
I was at work. I got myself to a television to watch the second plane hit the World Trade Center. That was amazing. It was just a stunning moment in history. Yep. You knew right away exactly what was going on.
Well, when the second plane hit, yeah.
Yes,
when the first plane hit, there was nothing but confusion. When the second plane hit, everyone knew it was an attack. Right?
It was a moment of being locked in, like at that moment. It was incredible.
You remember how much time you spent the next few weeks just watching TV, and that was literally the only thing on TV was 9/11.
And that was the invention of the full-time 24-hour scroll crawl at the bottom of your TV and all the news networks. Yep. That started it, and it never went away.
The ticker did that for the financial channels, I thought.
But the news ticker, you're saying that was the beginning of the news ticker?
Yes, the beginning of the the beginning of the 24-hour news ticker. I think they used to have it on during special events or special...
All right, 24-hour.
Special developments. But when 9/11 hit, that was it. Now, they never took it away. It's now on forever. CNN, Fox, all of them use it.
Well, there's another big event that happened just today.
That's right. The world did not end.
The world did not end today. The Large Hadron Collider was turned on today. So we had spoken about this before. The LHC is now the world's largest super collider.
Largest device ever built, I think. The most complicated machine ever built is pretty amazing.
The thing I love most about this whole project, it's great that it's going to teach us so much about the universe and everything. But what I really, really, really love about it is that it's made all of my coworkers suddenly interested in science. And they all keep coming up to me saying, so what's going on with this CERN thing? And it's really cool. And I'm sure, their interest was spurred mostly by our possible doom. Mm-hmm. But they very quickly... all of them were a little initially fearful, like, is this something I should worry about? And then once we started talking about it, they were just totally hooked and absolutely fascinated by the things they're going to be doing. So CERN, not just for, the actual discoveries they're going to make, but go for science communication.
Yes, big budget science. It gets a lot of attention.
I haven't seen that aspect of this phenomenon, so that's cool, actually. That makes me feel a little better because... I've kind of like mired myself into the whole aspect of all these doomsayers and what they have to say, and I've read so many comments of people who read these articles, and my faith in scientific literacy and actual just English grammar is so bad right now that it's just pathetic. But hey, we're alive. The scientists didn't kill us. Yay! The past few days, I've seen more anxiety than almost since the Y2K. 8 years ago. It's amazing all these people freaking out over literally nothing, and they're wrong on multiple levels, actually. But I would, like Steve and Rebecca were saying, that today was the day that the LHC, which stands for Lame Hysterical Crackpots, Large Hadron Collider.
You worked on that all day, didn't you?
Oh, no, just for 2 minutes. Supposed to turn on today and apparently create microscopic black holes that would swallow the Earth, and also maybe... strangelets that would convert all matter to strangelet goo.
But they haven't actually collided any protons yet.
That's one of the levels in which they're wrong. The first level in which people are wrong is that they turned it on and nothing happened, so that's wrong on that level. Second level is that they didn't even collide anything today. I read articles by apparently reputable news sites, and they're talking about colliding protons. I'm like, hello? I mean, that's the most basic thing. No, they're not colliding today.
It'll be a couple of months, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a few months. So they turned the beam on, and it went clockwise, and then 5 hours later, it went counterclockwise, and yay, that's great big news and break out the champagne, but nothing collided today.
How much would you have shit if at some random time you heard this? That would have been it, right?
Is that the sound that you think black holes make, or
no? Just imagine like that's right out of a movie. Like everyone's walking down the street in the city, la 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 la. Then all of a sudden, everyone looks up into the sky, and that sound
was that a phaser on built up to self destruct? What was that, Jay?
I just pulled it off the web.
Yeah. What was the name of that sound?
Oh my God! You need to turn this into a total geek out.
It's called the Whirling Dervish.
It was actually. No, I'm not going to get into it. I have my ways.
I believe that was from Babylon 5.
Let's just...
Episode 3A.
Guys, the Hadron Collider was turned on today.
It's called the Omega.
I swear to God, all the magnets in my house reversed the polarities.
And the fillings in my teeth came out.
Only the mercury ones, though.
I just had those put in, too.
But I think it should be said, though, that scientists, they took very seriously their responsibility to assess the risk of these types of experiments. They've been studying it for years. Many studies have been done by first and third party scientists, and they all concluded that there's nothing to worry about. The LHC Safety Assessment Group, called LSAG, updated their review of an analysis that they did in 2003. This is a group of independent scientists, and they said, I quote, LSAG reaffirms and extends the conclusion of the 2003 report that LHC collisions present no danger and that there's no reasons for concern. Whatever the LHC will do, nature has already done many times over the lifetime of the Earth and other astronomical bodies. And that's a key point. That's one of the, for me, that was the most compelling argument. Now, cosmic rays, are pretty much slamming into the upper atmosphere of the Earth and all the other planets for billions of years, and with much, much greater energy, orders of magnitude greater energy than anything we're going to do with the LHC. And nothing has happened. James Hughes is a lecturer at Trinity College. He says that the risks of the Hadron Collider creating a catastrophe was on the same level at which you're driving down the road and having your car spontaneously turn into a horse through simple quantum fluctuations. That's kind of like what we're talking about here. For this to happen, like people are saying, it would be equivalent to that. It's just pretty crazy.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think about the media referring to the LHC as the Big Bang machine?
Well, I mean, it's not completely inaccurate. I mean, part of the goal is to recreate a moment in time billionths of a second after the Big Bang. So, yeah, I mean, that's better than God particle, that's for sure.
And how exactly does it do
and
that?
Even Brian Cox calls it the Big Bang machine. He has a fantastic BBC documentary about it that I suggest everyone run to Google or run to YouTube and check out.
No, I agree.
I've heard
I've heard other scientists do that as well. The only thing is what Bob described is correct, that it's going to recreate conditions shortly after the Big Bang, in that it's going to be producing high energy collisions, the kind of collisions that occurred in those moments just after the Big Bang. But I hear a lot of reporters saying it's going to recreate a small Big Bang, and that's not really true. I think that's misleading. That's
what I've recreate that misleading. A small Big Bang? That's, I mean, you can't do that.
It'll make a little universe.
Like, it's going to make a tiny Big Bang in the lab. No, it's not really. It's a slight misconception about what they're actually
Eventually, it will
do.
Lead to tiny Earth with tiny us creating a tinier Big Bang.
And they create one, and then they make a
Except so when they create the new universe, everyone won't be normal. They'll all be Smurfs.
Right. Alternate universe. They'll create a Smurf universe.
Write me out of that universe.
Did you guys see the news report about the Indian girl who committed suicide over fears that the world is going to end?
Oh, that's true.
Well,
that.
She was right. Like her world ended.
Her wow. world ended. Yeah. So this apparently in India, the media had a real field day with just absolute scaremongering and 10 times worse than anything that we heard over here in our
wow.
country. The news report from MSNBC actually flat out says that, I'll quote the article, "But in deeply religious and superstitious India, fears about the experiment and the minor risks associated with it spread rapidly through the media." And this girl, you know, who knows what her mental state was at baseline, but she was apparently really, really frightened over the last couple of days about the world ending, and she committed suicide.
How old is this girl?
16.
Oh.
I know that committing suicide is inherently an irrational thing to do, but if the world was going to end anyway, like, why kill yourself?
Yeah. I'd want to see it go. I'd like to see it.
She was probably, you know, mentally ill.
Right.
And
yeah.
You know, as much as I blame the media for blowing this all out of proportion, I don't know that you can really put her death on the hands of just the media. I mean, that's
right.
the fault of a superstitious culture and, you know, a lack of, if, you know, unless she was just severely mentally ill.
Yeah, but it was offered as one sort of anecdotal example of the irrationality occurring in that culture. But even outside of that, the media created such a frenzy that the reports were that thousands of people were going to the temples to pray and to fast and basically prepare for the end. Yeah, so it was really widely believed that this was
going to
be a doomsday scenario.
Another way that you can see the impact that the media had on this is in the problems faced by the scientists at CERN. I know that Brian Cox and his wife got actual death threats, and not just, you know, vague, you know, crazy ranting email death threats, but things that were viable enough that they had to have security at the research center to keep out possible, mm-hmm. you know, people who probably saw Terminator and thought that it was a documentary, like,
right. wow.
the world, these scientists are going to end the world and we have to stop them. Anyway.
With pitchforks and torches.
But can we just talk right now about how cool this thing is, though? I mean, the pictures of it are incredible. It was a Herculean feat for them to design it and to actually execute building it and everything. I'm very, very impressed with the whole operation.
It's amazing.
It just the coolness of it, just from a freaking science fiction perspective, you know, just the way that it looks and everything.
Yeah.
It's totally incredible.
And the science is going to be damn cool. I mean, they're going to smash particles together and discover new particles, you know, maybe the Higgs boson, maybe fill in some of the missing pieces.
Stephen Hawking says no, though.
Well, Steve, that points to something that I feel needs to be addressed. A lot of these comments that I'm reading, people are saying that they're pointing to the fact that they think it was a waste of time and money. Here's one guy called Molten Metal. He said that we have to be satisfied with the so-called trickle-down benefits of this boondoggle. These scientific mega projects are a huge waste of efforts and resources. Now, this guy, Molten Metal, you know, he may think that this is a waste, but maybe he's not aware that, you know, it wasn't Al Gore that created the World Wide Web. It was CERN that actually created the web as we know it today. And there's other things, too, that you might not even be aware of. The LHC will generate a gigabyte of data every second when it's running. So the engineers there had to create a unique data handling methods to store and distribute petabytes of data across the web. And so they're calling this the grid. This new grid is being touted as a next generation internet that'll be 10,000 times faster than most broadband connections. I mean, this thing is going to cause revolutions, not just in our scientific understanding of the universe. And that's the other aspect of it that this guy, Molten Metal, I don't think is appreciating. The universe, 95% of the universe is dark energy and dark matter. We have no idea what the hell that stuff is. And then, like Steve said, the Higgs boson, just from a pure scientific understanding of the universe, the beginning of it, the end of it, I mean, isn't that reason enough to do this? And Hawking, I think, had the best quote. He said that both the LHC and the space program are vital if the human race is not to stultify and eventually die out. Together, they cost less than 0.1% of world GDP. If the human race cannot afford this, then it doesn't deserve the epithet human.
Mm-hmm.
Comments like the one you quoted, Bob, I think just illustrate a basic incuriosity about the world that really needs to be addressed. I think
can't relate to it.
at a young level. Mm-hmm. I think we need to, you know, focus on encouraging children to explore the wonders of the universe and teaching them that those things have value in and of themselves. It's not just all about making your Blu-ray disc faster or something.
That's absolutely cheaper. Right, but even in the point that it's making, that it's not practical, it's demonstrably historically ignorant, because there have been incredible benefits to humanity from scientists pursuing basic science questions out of just nothing but their scientific curiosity with no specific projected application. Mm-hmm. And yet that improves our understanding of nature and the world and leads to applications that nobody thought of or anticipated. Sometimes the biggest breakthroughs occur in that way that have the greatest impact on civilization. So it's just downright silly to say that this is like big egghead science that doesn't have anything directly applicable. You know, if you're going to do translational science, you're going to translate basic science understanding to specific applications, you got to have the basic science to translate. You know, that's the beginning of all of this.
And I'll end it with three of my favorite quotes or comments. Here's one by Martin. Mm-hmm. He says, "If things do go tits up and our universe gets sucked up its own ass, will I have time to run across your office and shag my secretary?" And then here's a good one. Somebody was ranting about, you know, God doesn't want us to do this, and somebody says, "Oh shit, someone's doing science. Bust out the torches and pitchforks."
Yeah. On the lighter side, this researcher in Japan believes that she has an elephant who can count.
She is a student at the University of Tokyo, and her name is Naoki Ire, a behavioral ecologist. And she is doing a doctoral thesis on, well, elephants that can supposedly count. Supposedly, there is this one elephant at the Yuno Zoo in Tokyo that she believes is able to add and gets the sums right 87% of the time, according to her calculations. And what she's doing is she has apples in buckets. So she's got two buckets. She puts three apples into one bucket so that the elephant can see it, and then five into another one right next to it. And then two more apples were put into each bucket, so leaving the first one with five and the second one with seven. And I guess 87% of the time the elephant would go for the bucket with more apples in it. Mm-hmm. And she believes that this is the elephant actually doing math and adding up the more desirable full bucket of apples.
Well, is it really the elephant doing math or just being able to judge volume?
Or number. I mean, so that's the question. And whenever you hear about animals being able to do anything like this, the first thing you have to ask yourself is this the clever Hans effect, right? Any kind of subconscious cues that are being given? Is the animal getting any other kind of cues? And it seems like those basic concerns have been addressed with the protocols that are being used. If we assume that it's not that the elephant actually is picking the larger amount, again, I think she said that all of her elephant subjects will do it about two-thirds of the time.
Right.
But this one particular elephant that performs the best is doing it 85, 87% of the time. If we assume that the protocol is tight and that they're actually doing that, then how do we interpret that behavior? Well, there's lots of animal species can estimate or compare numbers and choose the larger number. Whether that means they have an abstract sense of number or they know what the specific number is, or they just know that's the larger amount over here versus the lesser amount. There's obviously evolutionary advantage to being able to tell, you know, compare amounts so you get more food, you know, in the most basic application. What's one difference specifically that they point out with this species, actually, I love the species name for this elephant, it's Elephas Maximus.
That's Roman name.
Yeah. Elephas Maximus.
Elephas Minimus is the one in that Bugs Bunny cartoon.
I guess other animals that can do that need a substantial difference, you know, in order to be able to pick the larger amount. So one thing that these elephants demonstrate is the ability to tell very slight differences. Like they will pick 7 over 6, which is the smallest difference that of any animal that's been tested for this ability. But the real question is, you know, by going through this process of like putting in four and then three apples on one side and maybe like two and then four apples on the other side, so the elephant has to know that at the end of that process which one has the more apples in it. Is that really doing math, or is it just two comparisons, you know, and being able to say, well, okay, well, this one looks like it was had of those two comparisons, this one was bigger, and therefore they can, enough so that they can get it right 2/3 of the time on average. You know what I mean? I'm not really sure there's anything resembling math going on in the elephant's head.
Yeah, even though that's how she's interpreting the data, I'm not sure that they've necessarily though covered the clever Hans effect though. I mean, we really don't know. I don't believe her studies were anywhere online.
You're right, Evan. It's just from that video that they showed on YouTube, and we'll link to it, of course, that it didn't appear to be blinded in any way. In other words, she was standing right there, and you know, the humans who were doing it know how many apples are in each bucket. So we're just trusting that they're not giving any subtle cues.
To me, that's a big red flag. If you don't cover for the clever Hans effect, then to me that's like ding, 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 something's not right. Yeah. 'Cause that is the first thing you think of. Animals counting, that's the first thing you think of. And if you don't blind for that, then you're just, I don't know, something's wrong. So something is just not right if you don't even take that into consideration.
Right.
And just for our listeners who don't know what the clever Hans effect is back in 1900, a German gentleman owned a horse, and his name was Clever Hans, and he was apparently able to perform these mathematical calculations. And he was investigated by, you know, scientists and professors and so forth, who initially signed off and said that yes, this horse was doing some counting. But then there was another fellow who came along, Dr. Albert Moll, who figured out what was really going on, and that it was the result of very subtle movements of the whip or other things that were going on that the horse was in fact reacting to and not really doing math. And once that was controlled for, the phenomenon disappeared. So that's the clever Hans effect,
right? So bottom line, we don't have enough evidence at our end to know if that's been adequately ruled out. We're being told it was, but we don't really know. And even if we assume that it was, there's problems of interpreting the implications of this ability. I believe elephants are smart, and you know that this is not necessarily an outrageous ability for them to have. There is speculation that because they travel in large herds and they have to keep track of a lot of young elephants, that maybe they evolved a better ability to sort of track numbers so they could sense when one of the baby elephants is missing. All right, that's plausible. It's pure speculation at this point, but that's plausible. It's the kind of thing that will need to be replicated and looked at in other ways to try to see what this really means. Let's do some of your questions and emails. First, we're going to start with some corrections from the last week's episode. We got about 30 million emails about this one.
Oh, my God, the birds. You people and your birds.
I made a couple offhand comments that I didn't really look up before I made them, unfortunately.
Kiwis
about
a fruit, move along.
Flightless birds, and I made a couple of mistakes. So I did mention that the ostrich is from Africa, but I said incorrectly that emus are from South America. Emus are, in fact, from Australia.
And I
said that kiwis were from Australia, when in fact kiwis are from New Zealand.
Why did you say that, Steve? My inbox is filled with furious Australians and
New Zealanders.
New Zealanders. I couldn't think of the word for them.
Yeah, Steve really got pissed at that.
And a couple Tasmanians.
People expect me to
nasty.
Screw up the facts, but when Steve pulls a fact out of his ass, it like the internet erupts.
Ass fact.
No. Usually just in relation to the Australians, because we have so many Australian listeners, and apparently
and they both get really upset when we make a mistake.
Yeah, apparently a good deal of New Zealander listeners too.
Right,
and a couple Tasmanian listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I do have to just the thing is, I don't prep every little thing that we say. You just throw some offhand comments, things I think I have straight in my head, but you know, sometimes it's late at night and I screw up. But I'm going to make up for it by giving you more details than you even wanted the first time. There actually is a flightless bird in South America. It's the Rhea, R-H-E-A. There's five different species of kiwi in New Zealand, five recognized or accepted species. It's not just one species, which I wasn't aware of.
It's fascinating.
And the Rhea, the kiwi, the emu, and the ostrich are all ratites. Did you guys know that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know what? I did not. I didn't.
They are
I'm
all
gonna,
Yeah.
Can you hold on? I'm going to go call my mother.
Which means that they lack a breastbone, which makes a lot of sense because the flight muscles are the ones that attach to the breastbone.
That
they don't
sucks.
Need flight muscles because they're flightless.
There's no white meat on these birds? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they don't have that. They wouldn't have the breast meat that, like, say, a flying bird would have. Now, penguins are flightless birds, but they're not related and they're not ratites.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
There's so many funny things I could say about what you just said that I'm just going to abstain.
Start with
just because
tight.
You
Thank
said
you.
The word breast multiple times.
Just right.
Don't.
I'm surprised you didn't.
My apologies
play on
to
Rhea
our listeners down under. I'll try to make sure I prep any comments I make about that part of the world before I do so again.
No, but look at it this way. This is a science podcast, and science is self-correcting.
Right, we underwent peer review.
And apparently Steve is self-correcting as well. Right. The next time we have Richard Saunders on, maybe we should just make it an all-Australia episode just to make up.
That's a great idea.
We could make it up just by going to Australia and New Zealand and visiting all of our listeners.
Yeah,
we've been talking about it, ready to do
Send
it. I want to go.
Tickets.
We really have
I'm
to
there.
Do it, guys.
I'm there.
Who could sponsor us? Let's think.
All right, next question. This one comes from Joe Plunk, no relation, from New York. Or not that I know of, could be.
No relation
Max's
to Max's
great-grandnephew or
right.
something. Lately at work, folks have been forwarding emails regarding the dangers of irradiated food. Many of the links they send out link to a Dr. Mercola's website, a doctor of osteopathy and holistic practitioner. Below is quoted directly from the email. The information highlights problems with the practice of irradiating food, include research that has been done. Then he gives links to articles on the Mercola website. Who is this guy, and is this stuff for real? Thanks.
Oh, who is he indeed? He is
who are these people?
Who is he is the easiest part of that email to answer. He is Joseph Mercola, who is a star of Quack Watch. Go look him up. It's fun. He's had, that's quackwatch.org. He has had two different warnings from the FDA for making illegal claims about products that he sold, like cancer cures, diabetes cures, Crohn's disease cures, none of which actually cure any of those. He believes just about any crazy thing that comes down the pike. He opposes immunization and fluoridation. He's a nut. However, all of that is not to say that he's wrong. He is wrong, but for, other reasons than him just being
Not just because he's a quack. He's wrong because he's actually, in fact, wrong.
He's a quack, and he's wrong.
Right.
So, he's got a website that is chock full of claims that it would take us 3 podcasts just to dissect. But to get to the point, do you have to freak out about irradiating food? Probably not. The FDA, the reason why this is probably coming up, I'm guessing, is because the FDA was looking into allowing certain purveyors of food to irradiate their food. I think spinach is on the short list.
And lettuce. Well, they just approved lettuce and spinach.
Okay.
Other foods have been approved, like meat and stuff like that, for a long time. They're adding them food by food because very, very quickly, the process of irradiation is to pass radiation through food to kill any bacteria or other organisms on there. Kills 99.9% of the organisms which contaminate food. But different food has different tolerance to different types of radiation. So you do have to find out what is the dose that will kill the bugs without harming the food itself, and some foods just can't be irradiated because they can't tolerate it. So the FDA does have to approve it food by food, and they just added lettuce and spinach to the list.
Right, and those were fast-tracked because of E. coli problems, which, and the irradiation would, in fact, kill the E. coli at the place where the food is processed. But, the problem is that a lot of people have trouble with the word irradiated, first of all. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of there's a big push from the industry to start calling it cold pasteurization. Because and
double plus
they have a point, the microwave nearly failed on arrival because people were kind of scared about using radiation to cook your food, but now we refer to it as nuking your food with no problem. So it's just a matter of it. You know, I think the first step was, you know, it was a scary word and that freaks a lot of people out. Like, my food is being irradiated. But basically, you know, irradiation's been going on for 50 years now. They've been doing studies on it. And there has been the occasional study that has shown, well, maybe it causes some problems like birth defects or something in animals. But with all of the studies that have been done, there's few studies that have shown that maybe there's some problem. They've never really been replicated, and they haven't been particularly convincing. Mm-hmm. And that's why the FDA said it's okay. And like Steve mentioned, they've been selling irradiated meat for since, I think, 1997. Not a lot of places sell it, but there are a few grocery stores that sell it, and also Omaha Steaks, which is a popular company that ships steaks or ships ground beef to around. They irradiate their ground beef, and there's no problem. It doesn't seem to affect the taste negatively. There's appear to be just as popular as anything else.
Is there any radiation left over by the time you get the product?
No, the problem isn't with radiation. Consider, like, you know, you go get x-rays done, you don't worry about, you know, the radiation left in your pants after you leave the place, you know. And x-rays are some of the, that's one form of radiation that they use in irradiation. But the problem is that, you know, that people worry about is that when you irradiate something, it changes the chemical composition of it. But what they don't really realize is that it appears to change it in exactly the same way that cooking it would change it. It's just that it's not actually cooking it.
Yeah, exactly. Not even as much. Cooking changes the chemical structure of food much more than radiation does.
You're right. And so one of the concerns is that, well, irradiation will destroy the nutrients in food. Well, not exactly, but it can decrease the nutrients to some extent, just
so
the way
cooking.
That in the same way that cooking does, right?
Yeah.
But to a lesser extent. So, you know, is there something to be afraid about with irradiation? No. Will irradiation cure everything, all the problems? Because, you know, there are a lot of illnesses that come from food that's being handled poorly. A lot of people I've seen complain about it because they feel that it's going to allow factories to get lax in their health standards.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not so sure that that will happen. I mean, but oversight is certainly the problem. Like, that's the main problem with why we have so much foodborne illnesses is a lack of oversight. So we would probably be better off encouraging more of that. If you really want to make sure that you don't get sick from your food, what you should be doing is, first of all, cleaning your food before you pop it in your mouth. And second of all, consider buying locally, because irradiating the food at the source is fine and will cure, you know, will kill 99% of the germs. But that food often takes a very long journey from wherever it started onto your plate. And the longer it has to go, the more you have to worry about who's touching it.
Teleport it.
Yeah, there you go.
Teleport it, yeah.
Bombard
so you might have
proton.
To wait a while. You might have to wait a while for that. But in the meantime, wash it, buy local, and don't worry if you happen to get an irradiated hamburger. You're not going to die. And don't listen to quacks.
I don't agree, though, that there has to be an either-or choice. I mean, I think that, yes, you should wash your food. You should cook it properly, too, by the way. So properly cooking food will actually take care of a lot of foodborne illnesses. But you can also irradiate the food. I mean, it will get rid of the bacteria and other, you know, organisms on the food, and it will increase the shelf life. If you look at the risk versus benefit of this as an added procedure, the benefit grossly outweighs any risks. The only real downside to it is that it's expensive. You know, it adds a little bit of a cost to the price of food, and the fact that the irradiating centers, there aren't actually that many of them, and they're mostly being used actually irradiating and sterilizing medical equipment.
Yeah.
So they're not really free to do food. But that's because there hasn't been a huge demand for irradiated food in this country, or in fact, there's been, you know, resistance to it. It's much more widely accepted in Europe, actually, where it's fine, you know, and nobody has a problem with it, which is interesting because in Europe, they're really anti-GM food, but they totally accept irradiated food. And in the United States, we're more accepting of GM food. There is still some resistance, but not nearly as much as there is in Europe. But there's this huge resistance to irradiated food. It's really all just, you know, the grassroots organizations and the media and just what, you know, fear-mongering and hysteria has been out there. It's not really based upon the actual evidence or any kind of a rational risk versus benefit assessment.
So it's okay to eat my head cheese? I'm all right?
Ew.
Head cheese or olive loaf. I like olive loaf.
Yeah.
Mm. Gross and grosser.
I think head...
head cheese sounds like what comes out on a Q-tip.
That's one of those enduring mysteries, is what exactly is head cheese? The other one, my favorite, though, one is luncheon meat. Ever seen that one?
yeah. It's just called luncheon meat.
They won't even tell you what's actually in there. No, thank you.
Well, they called it luncheon flesh. That would be perfect.
Luncheon flesh.
No. Oh, my God. That's disgusting.
I'm in favor of calling foods exactly what they are, though. Like, not right. Pork anymore,
well,
but
the
pig.
German word for meat is Fleisch. It's flesh.
Fleisch.
You know, guys, really, nothing is grosser than head cheese because head cheese is meat byproduct mixed with gelatin.
Yeah.
That's like that's still like horse hooves, right?
Yep, it's made from real hooves.
Could be algae.
No, didn't they did change it, didn't they?
Yeah, it's mostly algae now.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Mark Gartner from Germany. And Mark says, "Dear skeptics with a C, I have studied philosophy and therefore I have bookmarked the RSS feed of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It's a peer-reviewed online encyclopedia that is freely accessible over the net and great resource for philosophers. It's far from being completed yet, but the articles are well-researched and updated regularly. So yesterday it published a new article about the demarcation between science and pseudoscience. After reading it, I wanted to ask you guys what exactly is the essence of science in your personal views and what makes a pseudoscience? You are debunking it all the time. Have you ever thought about the criteria you use while doing this?" And then he gives a link to the article. Well, thanks, Mark. And I sent Mark back a link to an article that I wrote on the demarcation line between science versus pseudoscience like 10 years ago. And I think I've updated it a couple of times since. So, yeah, we have thought about it a little bit. I know we've talked about this on the show before, but I don't know that we've ever gone systematically through the demarcation between science and pseudoscience. And it is very core to what we do, so I thought we could go over some of the key features. Mark referred to the demarcation problem, what philosophers call the problem of where do you draw the line, right, between science and pseudoscience. And there actually isn't any sharp line. You can't draw a sharp line between the two because it's a spectrum, right? So again, science versus pseudoscience is therefore a false dichotomy because it isn't just these two discrete things. It's like what's the difference between a cult and a religion? It's actually a spectrum from one end to the other with, you know, shades of gray in between. But there are features of pseudoscience, and the more of these features you possess, then the more pseudoscientific your beliefs or your endeavors are. So here I'm just going to quickly go through what I think are some of the key features or red flags of pseudoscience. One is hostility towards scientific criticism. Proponents of a specific belief respond to the scientific community, you know, critically analyzing them by saying that they're being picked on or there's a conspiracy against them. And that hostility clearly betrays an unfamiliarity with how science functions day to day. Normally, science thrives on criticism. So hostility towards that criticism means that what you're doing is not science. Another feature is proponents of pseudoscience will attempt to make a virtue out of ignorance. Someone who doesn't really have any background in science will try to say that, well, that therefore I'm not brainwashed or I'm not indoctrinated into the narrow-minded mindset of the scientist. I'm free to think outside the box.
Yeah, that's the "my mind is so open, my brain fell out" argument.
Right, exactly. Actually, I think that the more you learn about a topic, the more intellectual tools you have to think in new and different ways. So, I mean, the best science is actually the most creative. You know, it's thinking of creative ways to test a hypothesis or a new way to explain existing data. So experience at being a scientist actually gives you the ability, in my opinion, to, in my experience, to think outside the box. So it really is just a way of saying that, hey, I don't understand anything about this discipline, but that gives me an advantage. I think Neil Adams said that a lot, you know, the fact that he wasn't a scientist. He was an advantage because he wasn't, you know, limited by all of the things that scientists think they know, you know, like all that evidence and stuff. Another feature is heavy reliance upon testimony or anecdotal evidence rather than specifically referenced research. That's very applicable in the medical realm, of course. You know, you see this again in all types of pseudoscience, but I think with medical pseudoscience, the personal anecdote is essentially the cornerstone of, you know, any unscientific modality. Fundamental principles are often based upon a single case. So chiropractic, for example, D.D. Palmer believes that he healed somebody of deafness by manipulating his neck, even though the pathway for hearing does never passes through the neck. The inventor of iridology believes that he diagnosed an owl's broken wing by looking at his iris. One case, and then the entire elaborate structure is built around this one case. Claims often promise simplistic solution to complex problems or questions. A common manifestation of this is the theories of everything, right? The people who think that they have the one theory that explains the entire multiverse. So that's always a huge red flag. There is no one simple scheme or one simple answer to explain all that there is. So the more people try to explain with less, the more skeptical you should be of it. Of course, scientists are legitimately trying to move towards those kind of fundamental theories, but they don't come out of whole cloth, you know.
And of course, the gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello has a very interesting super theory of super everything. But
is that right?
It's true, yeah. And three of our audience members are going, yes, Gogol Bordello.
Right. Super. Steve, what about subject to modification as new evidence and observations are made?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit further down my list, but I put that under starting with the conclusion and then working backwards. So if you have your conclusion fixed, then and just you're just retrofitting or retrodicting the information you want. Like on Mercola, he has started with the conclusion that irradiation was bad, then he cherry-picked all the evidence that seemed to support that conclusion rather than looking at all the evidence and then trying to move forward with that, or modifying, as you say, your theory or hypothesis as new evidence comes in. So, you know, straight chiropractic is they're saying the same things they were saying 100 years ago.
Creationism,
you know,
ID.
Creationism, you know, it's a fixed belief. Fixed beliefs are not science. But so if you're just retrofitting or cherry-picking data to support a fixed belief, That I think, is actually the absolute heart and soul of pseudoscience. Because the key, and Mark asked what the key to science is, it's that you have to move forward, right? You have to make predictions and then revise your beliefs based upon the results of your observations. If you start with the answer, you can't be doing science. You are doing pseudoscience. Quickly, I'm going to run through a few more. Using scientific sounding but ultimately meaningless language or jargon.
It's perfectly cromulent.
Perfectly cromulent. Scientists have legitimate jargon because it's when language is used to increase the precision and of language and to make it unambiguous.
Disambiguate.
Right. So like, if I may say, use a term like distal or proximal to refer to a location on the body, those have very specific meaning. But if you listen to a pseudoscientist, often they use words that are more fancy, if you will, than they have to be. So it's like adding complexity to language without adding precision or without reducing ambiguity. That's always a red flag. Or, in fact, using words that are made to confuse and to befuddle rather than to illuminate.
Randy calls it gobbledygook when they say such things.
Yeah.
Pure gobbledygook.
Right. Or just technobabble. Right, it's just made to impress, but also actually lack specificity. Use bold or absolute statements rather than the very conservative qualifying statements that a careful scientist uses, attempting to shift the burden of proof away from you. So you can't prove me wrong, right? You can't prove it that my theory is not true. That's backwards. If it's your theory, then the burden's upon you to prove it correct.
Or how about overturning all existing science for your one theory?
Yeah, right. So, again, a lot of this does come back to Neil Adams because he was such a great
example. So ridiculous.
He was the prototype.
Yeah, it's always the prototype. So, yeah, you know, if you're just overturning established science left and right, it's like, yeah, wow, that just becomes incredibly implausible after a while, you know. You know, making vague references to data, you know, scientists have shown, experts say, but not giving a specific reference that somebody could check up. And then finally, I mean, there are more, but just the final one I'll mention is a failure to consider all hypotheses. So it's very common to limit the choices of different explanations for something to the one you want plus a couple of token other ones that you can easily dismiss to make it seem like you're, you know, sorting through different hypotheses. But when you prematurely or falsely narrow the list of possibilities ahead of time, it's just a way of rigging the game, right? So like for the UFOlogist, they'll say, oh, there's a light in the sky. Well, it's not a plane. It's not a balloon. Therefore, it's an alien spacecraft. Okay, what about the 100 other things you didn't mention, you know? Whereas, you know, scientists are careful to consider every possible interpretation of the data before them and eliminate every possible one before they arrive at a conclusion. And part of that is because they know if they don't do it, someone else will. You know, that's where the peer review comes back into play and the meat grinder of peer review. Someone else will do it if they don't. Whereas pseudoscientists are hostile to that review. They want, you know, they know their conclusion, they have their argument, and they don't want to be pushed off of it. Well, let's go on with our interview. Sitting with us now is Ben Radford, who is the managing editor of the Skeptical Inquirer. Ben, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hey, Ben.
Hey. Hey. Oh, my God. There's lots of people here.
Hello.
Hey, hi.
And
they're all looking at me.
Party.
I find this rather odd.
Now, you have just come from giving a seminar at TAM6. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I just got done giving a two-hour special scientific paranormal investigations workshop. Basically sort of going over the methodologies that I use when I've, you know, as your listeners may or may not know, I've been investigating all sorts of weirdness ranging from lake monsters to crop circles, miracles, and other manner of weirdness for about 10 years now. And basically what had happened was that after I would give talks about these things, people would come up and say, yeah, that's really cool. You know, how do you do that? How do you do these investigations? And I was like, you know, watch Scooby-Doo. I mean, that's the old Scooby-Doo, not the new Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, right.
But then finally, I didn't want to give somebody a glib answer because people were genuinely curious about how you do this. And so basically, I put together a workshop here at TAM, and it sold out. It's apparently been really good feedback so far. And just basically, you know, showing people, you know, the methodologies, a lot of the skeptical principles, you know, going into logical fallacies, you know, how to investigate things, eyewitnesses, and this and that.
Give us a couple of pearls. What are a couple of, like, the real nuggets that you teach people how to do successful investigations?
Well, one of the main ones is, of course, to ask the right questions. That's job one, because if you're not asking the right questions, you're not going to get the right answers. And I see this over and over. Like, for example, when I occasionally deign to watch shows like Ghost Hunters or Sci-Fi Investigates or this and that, it's bizarre to me because presumably these people are you know, believing that they are actual investigators, like, oh, we're actually looking for ghosts, we're this and that. And there's no scientific methodology to them whatsoever. They're not asking the right questions. They don't even know where to start. And to my mind, it's like, well, why do you bother? I mean, if you're not going to take this seriously, if you're not going to use science, if you're not going to genuinely try to figure these things out, other than being on TV, why are you doing this?
And I think you just answered your question.
Yeah, they don't care.
Right.
They
right.
just want to have fun and get recognition.
Plus, they think they're doing science.
Yeah, a lot of them do. And that's what I find sort of interesting but kind of sad. The things that are self-evidently bad science and wrong are routinely employed by them. So that's one of them, is ask the right questions. Another one is The devil is in the details, mm-hmm. and you know, and you've seen this guy. You know, you guys have talked about other claims before. Is that, you know, you have to get to the nitty gritty. Okay, what exactly is being claimed? Mm-hmm. What specifically under what circumstances are they saying that, you know, this cures this, or, you know, under what circumstances is this person saying that they can, you know, talk to dead people? As you narrow down the claims more and more and more, you find that many of them are solvable, and it's not that I'm the smartest guy on earth, because I'm sure as hell not, but I do good research, and mm-hmm. it's do your research.
Yeah. Yeah, 95% of the work is framing the question.
Absolutely.
You've already done most of the work by the time you're actually running some kind of experiment or doing some kind of observation. And that's exactly what they don't do, like on the ghost hunters. They just waving their equipment around and confirming their beliefs.
Yeah, there's no methodology behind it. There's no rationale behind it. It's just sort of,
anomaly hunting.
Ben, don't you think it's even worse than that? I think a producer shows up with a small crew and actually, you know, goes in, investigates the place, says, okay, we're going to shoot here, we're going to shoot here, we're going to do this. They're just finding points of interest and things that they can exploit. The science is probably the absolute last thing they would even think of.
Right. You're exactly right. Is that, you know, so many of these TV shows, they're driven exactly by what will make good TV, not mm-hmm. what makes sense. Not, I mean, for example, there was a TV show called Sci-Fi Investigates. It's, I may even still be on. And at one point, they spend half the show basically trying to make a hoaxed Bigfoot video. Mm-hmm. The problem is that there's no value in that whatsoever. That there is no scientific investigative value to making a fake Bigfoot video, because that says nothing about the existing Bigfoot videos. And even if you fool somebody, all that means is that one particular video fooled that one person. So there's no use or value at all in doing this, yet it was obviously some stunt that the producer dreamed up. Oh, you know what'll make cool? In the third act, we're going to make this Bigfoot video. Why?
Yeah.
They might have even seen it on Penn and Teller's bullshit because did that.
Right.
Exactly.
Right, right. I got to clear that. Oh, hold on a second. That's good.
That looks good. Yeah. Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a demonstration. It's not an experiment, mm-hmm. as you say. The only value I see in that is when someone specifically claims you couldn't fake this. Mm-hmm. Is it? Yeah, well, here it is. Here's a fake. Mm-hmm. Like the recent alien at the bedroom window. And we would take thousands of dollars for a Hollywood studio to this. How about 90 bucks on my computer?
How about a balloon and a magic marker?
Might as well.
There you go. And again, I mean, just because we can prove that it could be duplicated, of course, that doesn't necessarily prove that it was fake.
Right, right.
But it does say
here's another explanation.
Here's another explanation. And furthermore, the claim that this could not be faked is demonstrably false. Right.
That's right. The one thing it addresses, the claim that it couldn't be faked.
Exactly. Right.
You've written some books before.
Tell
us about your books.
I've written or co-written three books. The first one is called Hoaxes, Myths, and Manias, Why We Need Critical Thinking. And that was co-authored by my friend Bob Bartholomew, who I think is somewhere in Darwin in Australia at the moment. Haven't heard from him in a while. Basically, that sort of, you know, involves critical thinking and examining unusual claims. My second book was called Media Mythmakers, How Journalists, Activists, and Advertisers Mislead Us. Mm-hmm. And that's more of a book on media criticism.
There's a lot to criticize.
Long book.
Yeah.
everything from, you know, misleading advertising claims to politics to just – it's basically critical thinking applied to everyday life in the media. And then my latest book was co-authored by Joe Nickel at PsychOp, and that is Lake Monster Mysteries, and investigating the world's most elusive creatures. And Joe and I spent probably 2 years, give or take 2-3 years, investigating lake monsters around the world. And in fact, to the best of my knowledge, it's the first and only scientific skeptical investigation of the world's lake monsters.
Did you find one?
Yeah, right.
I did kind of find a lake monster. I'll just give you the thumbnail sketch, but there is a lake in Crescent, which is called Crescent Lake in Newfoundland, and that creature is supposed to be thin and dark black, and it's supposed to be eel-like. There's only been a handful of sightings about it, which is really unusual, given that it's supposed to be there forever or a long time. So I was interviewing eyewitnesses and getting this and that. Finally asked, said, you know, are there big eels in the lake? The guy's like, oh, yeah, big eels. I'm thinking, okay.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible that your lake monster is a big eel? Oh, yeah, could be.
Game okay. over.
Well, I think I solved the case.
Yeah, define monster, basically,
is what
it comes down to.
Right, and so, but it was interesting because, you know, as with many lake monsters, there's a tourism element to it. And to him, I mean, whatever, if he wants to label Big Eel a monster, that doesn't bother me. It's interesting, you know, but that's a case of where I think there was some validity to the sighting.
I had no idea that there was a bunch of lake monsters.
How many?
There are certainly hundreds, if not thousands.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh, yeah, sure. And in fact, Canada has more lake monsters than any other country in the world.
Really?
Wow.
They have more lakes? Mike on that.
There you go. They have more lakes.
Ben, give us the dumbest one.
The dumbest lake monster?
Yeah, like, there's got to be a story out there. It's like, you know, looks like a piece of styrofoam.
Look at that. Very curious.
It's got a bark-like skin.
Oh, very
odd. Or a log-shaped monster.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many dumb ones to choose from. I guess one of my favorites is the Lake Champlain monster, just because I've done so much work on that.
Yep.
Joe and I did that in Skeptical Inquirer magazine and also 40 Times in other places. It's a case of where if you look at the best evidence, it just falls apart. Again, the devil is in the details. So if all you see is that picture taken in 1977 by Sandra Mansi of the best evidence, best photographic evidence for lake monsters, if all you see is that, yeah, hell, what the hell? That could be a lake monster.
Well, what was it?
It was a log. It was a floating log.
Oh my God! Really? I thought that was a joke.
No. But that's exactly the point. If you go from the big claim, ooh, this is a picture of a lake monster, to, well, hold on, what are the details? What are the specifics here? What did they actually see? You know, well, where was this taken? How far away was it? You start getting the details, and the story falls apart.
Yeah. I've also heard that schools of fish have been mistaken as log.
Yes.
How about swimmers?
Yes. It's my understanding that on more than one occasion, particularly in Lake Tahoe, there have been reports of lake small lake monsters, mind you.
Human-sized.
Well-endowed swimmers have apparently...
Well...
suddenly she's interested.
Yeah, she's like,
suddenly she pipes up like, I'm sorry, what was that?
Ben, can you describe their breasts, please?
Breasts. Do we have names? Yeah. But no, so they're, you know, anytime anybody sees something odd in the lake, that's what they're going to go for.
Do you ever look into larger, like, ocean myths?
Sure.
Giant squids, things
like that?
Yeah,
giant squids. In fact, I've done some research on giant squids again in Newfoundland.
Kraken.
The Kraken is a sort of mythological take on that.
In fact, how crazy is that, though? It's not that crazy.
Well, no. There certainly are giant squids, and in fact, I smelled one.
Wow.
Museum in Newfoundland, St. John's.
So, it's called what's Duckler. A giant squid smell like?
Calamari.
It's very formaldehyde, a little garlicky, almost tangy. I mean, I almost wanted to lick it. Yeah. I don't want to get perverse. But yeah.
I'm a giant squid.
Are you?
Wait, let me get my camera.
But no, I mean, that sort of thing where, again, that's a good example of something that, you know, there is a scientific basis for. There is a scientific basis for some lake monsters, and the giant squid is definitely one of them. And in fact, there's even a larger squid called the colossal squid, which is bigger than the giant squid, oddly enough, if you go by the nomenclature. Yep.
Then there's the super effing large squid.
Oh my God!
But it gets, the silly part about it is, okay, so let's say you investigate 1,000 lakes and you find a quote unquote lake monster. At the moment you find it, it's no longer a monster, you know, because a monster means, you know, nobody knows about it, it's hidden or something's, it's like under the guise of something else.
It's just an animal.
But if it's there, it's an animal at that point.
Right. And you make a good point. In fact, that's why, you know, there are people who call themselves cryptozoologists, you know, crypto meaning hidden zoologists. So so people who, you know, look for, you know, chupacabras or, you know, the lake monster, the Bigfoot, whatever, they consider themselves to be sort of on the cutting edge of finding these monsters. And I've debated with them. I said, name one animal that any cryptozoologist has ever found. Like, blah, blah, blah. I said, no. Because they'll say, like, giant panda, coelacanth. And I said, well, no. Those were found by zoologists, right. By scientists.
Yeah.
These were not found by people looking for Bigfoot. So this is actually one of the problems they have, is that they're having a hard time legitimizing their so-called scientific search for these creatures.
Well, how dare you say that to them? I mean, my God.
Well, it's funny. It's funny because it parallels, if you look at parapsychologists, I think, we talk about things that are paranormal. Well, if a parapsychologist could ever prove ESP, well, it's no longer paranormal. Now mm-hmm. it's got a scientific
basis.
Yeah, yeah. And Richard Dawkins talked about that mm-hmm. at TAM 3. He talked about things that are parinormal. I think he was trying to coin that word. I don't think it caught on.
Didn't quite catch.
But
memes is better.
Right. Yeah. He should just relax with that. But no, paranormal things that are on the cusp. And I think he might have thrown cryptozoology mm-hmm. in there as something that, mm-hmm. you know, could potentially happen, you know, mm-hmm. but probably isn't.
Are there any cryptozoologists that actually have a degree in anything worthwhile?
The main one, the main scientific, and I'm doing the scare quotes for those of you who can't see, the main one is a guy named Jeff Meldrum, who is a professor of anatomy at Idaho State University. And I've met Jeff a couple times. He's a nice guy. I don't think he's happy with me because I've criticized him pretty heavily in many things, but he is the main sort of scientific guy, the go-to guy for Bigfoot. And he does have a degree and he has a PhD. The problem is that his PhD is in anatomy. Mm. His PhD is not in mysterious creatures. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that he's misapplying his – he does have knowledge. I mean, he certainly knows more about anatomy than I do. But the problem is that he's trying to apply that to, you know, like Bigfoot, you know, tracks. And he's going to say, well, you know, if this were a real creature, I can tell you how all the bones would fit together. Okay, but if that's a hoax, then everything you're saying means nothing. So there are some people, there's only a handful of them. And again, if there was a body for them to examine, then they have credibility. If they're just sort of, you know, using their profession and science behind it, just as sort of, you know, as a springboard for wild speculation, then.
Oh, who would do that?
Come on. Yeah. All
right. Sounds like, you know, with most of the pseudosciences that we cover, there seems to be one or a few people who have formal training, but they're cranks.
Yes.
And then they're the leaders of a vast army of amateurs. So you just mm-hmm. have basically cranks and amateurs in these kind of fields.
But they're right. The rock stars, though. I mean,
yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
And then they get sucked into that world. And then, like with HIV denial, that, you know, the guy who denied that at first, then suddenly his career turns into being a crank for HIV denial. Yeah. That's all he's about.
Duesenberg, is that?
Duesenberg, yeah. Right. So it's the same thing. You get this guy. Duesenberg?
Duesenberg.
That's a good one. I got to use that.
Sure. thanks for bringing the level down.
Yeah, it's not that
I'm there for you.
Ben, it's been wonderful sitting with you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks for inviting me in. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys have been doing very well this year, I must say.
You suck.
Oh, thank you.
or I suck. You could look at it either way, I guess. But
sorry,
here we go.
A little punchy.
You guys ready for this week?
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Yes.
Let's go.
Item number 1. Scientists discover the first animal that can survive the vacuum and radiation of space. Item number 2. A new study shows that, contrary to prior belief, higher intelligence is associated with a decreased ability to delay gratification. And item number 3. Scientists discover that giant honeybees are able to perform a quote-unquote Mexican wave, like fans at a sporting event, in order to deter predators.
What?
Evan, go first.
Scientists discovering the first animal that can survive the vacuum and radiation of space? Right. Space worm or something. And then number 2 was the new study showing that, contrary to prior beliefs, higher intelligence is associated with a decreased ability to delay gratification. That sounds pretty plausible. And then the last one was scientists discovered that giant honeybees are able to perform a Mexican wave fans at a sporting event in order to deter predators. Wow. That first one's way too over the top. I don't know. Maybe you're trying to trick us up this week, Steve. I mean, that's so over the top, you've got to say that that's fiction, but it could be the curveball. And something's telling me about the higher intelligence study, decreased ability to delay gratification. I can't put my finger on it, but that one's not striking a chord with me too well. So I'll say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
The scientists discovering
an animal that can survive the vacuum of radiation of space? Well, the first thing I thought of was that I don't know what your definition of animal is, because I would think
it's pretty much the definition of animal, a member of the animal kingdom.
So bacteria does not make that list, correct?
They would be a member of the bacterial kingdom.
Look, don't get smart with me, smarty pants, right? I'm just trying. Because I know that bacteria, or some bacteria, can withstand outer space, I think.
Well, just to be clear, I use the word animal in a precise scientific taxonomical sense.
Okay, so no insects either then, huh?
Insects are animals. They're a part of the animal kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Are they marsupials? Not everyone will get that one, but those who do will enjoy it.
People in Australia and New Zealand.
Yes, invertebrates are part of the animal kingdom.
Okay, so there's just something. I bet you there's some small, microscopic type bug out there. If that one isn't fake. Okay, moving on. New study shows that contrary to prior beliefs, higher intelligence is associated with a decreased ability to delay gratification. That's very strange. I'm not even sure what it means.
Sound it out.
Like delaying gratification, like, you know.
Like marsupials?
The two key words is contrary and decreased.
But what are you talking about? Like you have a meal and you don't feel good about it for a few hours? Like what are we talking here?
No, do you want $1,000 today or $4,000 in 10 years? Delayed gratification.
All right, yeah, let me wrap this one up, okay?
Wrap it.
Please.
Right. Thanks, Jay. Please.
The last one. I know you're riveted, Rebecca. That's why
I really am.
Moving it forward. Please. Scientists discover that giant honeybees are able to perform a Mexican wave like fans at a sporting event in order to deter predators.
See, fly.
That one, I truly believe is true. I know I may know things about this. I may not. I'm not going to reveal that. But that one, I'm not questioning. So between one and two, I would say that number one is the fake, the bug in space.
Okay, Rebecca.
Bugs in space.
Okay, yeah. I do believe that it's crazy, but I do think that it's possible there's a microscopic organism that could survive space. And I also believe that honeybees would be able to perform a Mexican wave sort of thing. We always just called it the wave because we're not racist in my family. But
yeah, when they do it, they at the very end they go ole,
ole. Yeah. It's well known that honeybees use physical actions to communicate, like little dances. So true. I can see that. However, the higher intelligence being associated with a decreased ability to delay gratification does not make much sense to me at all, because the smart thing to do in many situations is to resist instant gratification in the hopes of greater future rewards. So I believe that that is false.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The animal surviving in a vacuum is a little tougher. I know bacteria can, but I'm sure that there are some organisms, some animal organisms that can survive it. Something probably pretty tiny.
I've wasted my life. We're screwed.
All right, the honeybees, that just seems too wacky on the surface of it not to be true. When I think about it, it seems totally plausible. The second one, though, is one that doesn't make sense to me. I would think that delaying gratification would be one of the hallmarks of higher intelligence. I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay, but you all agree that giant honeybees use Mexican waves to repel predators, to deter predators.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And that is science.
We knew it. We all knew it.
Yeah. Now, the Mexican wave was in the title. I didn't
Racist.
Make up that term.
It is in quotes, so So for all, yeah.
Yeah, I'm quoting the article.
Oh, right. So quotes make it less racist.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
It's true.
Whatever you say, cracker. I just did a...
Oh, my God.
Is that in quotes?
I just did some air quotes around that. So...
This phenomenon is known as shimmering. Giant honeybees will...
Shimmer.
In a hundreds of them at a time will, in a coordinated fashion, shimmer or, like, have a wave propagate along, you know, the network of bees. And they'll do this in order to deter, like, wasps or other predators from attacking bees in the nest. The giant honeybees have an open nest. They don't have the enclosed nests. So that's why they needed to evolve this kind of defense mechanism. And they'll actually change the amplitude and frequency with which they do this, depending on how far away the wasp is. So when they're far away, they'll do it. And I think, well, maybe it might make the wasp think that it's one big organism, so that way it won't attack it. And then when it gets closer, it does it less frequently. And I think maybe that's, you know, that may serve the function of confusing the wasp in some way.
I've heard but it does, that they can also sing Sweet Caroline in unison.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If you've never seen it, look it up on YouTube. It's actually a really cool thing that these animals do.
Right.
I never heard of that. That's cool.
Can they survive space, though?
They call it shimmering. Well, let's go to number one, since you guys want to talk about that one.
Oh, boy.
Nice try, Steve.
Scientists discover the first animal that can survive the vacuum and radiation of space. And that one is science.
Nice.
That's wild.
This animal is cool. Tardigrade?
This is Bob got it. This is the tardigrade, or the water bear.
Oh,
it
water
is an
bear.
Animal.
That sounds adorable.
It's a water bear.
it's a microscopic animal.
And then they just let them float out in space.
Yeah, they let them float around.
Yeah, so it's been a year since they were sent up since ecologist Ingemar Johnson, I probably butchered that name, sent up some water bears, microscopic water bears, 3,000 of them, in fact, on a 12-day space trip. This was research supported by the European Space Agency.
Steve, why did they pick that insect? Did they suspect it could?
Well, they wanted to see what would happen. And to be clear, tardigrades are not insects. They actually form their own phylum in the animal kingdom.
Well, Jay, I remember reading about these. These little guys are the definition of hardy. I remember my memory is telling me about an article I read many years ago that these tardigrades can survive 100 years. If they're like desiccated, completely dried out, I think they found some that were 100 years old. You add some water and poop, they start walking around
like
after
monkeys.
100 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so they go into
amazing.
A dormant state if they get dehydrated, and then they'll come back out if you rehydrate them.
Wow,
they could survive under the ice. They could survive in lots of extreme conditions. And apparently, they can survive in outer space.
Water bears versus sea monkeys.
I wonder if they have any of that DNA repairing mechanisms that...
They think that they might have special molecules involved in DNA repair.
Because some bacteria have that ability to actually repair shredded DNA, which is kind of a cool ability.
Yeah, DNA, but that's one of the things that they're researching that hasn't been established yet, but that's the hypothesis. Which means that a new study shows, contrary to prior beliefs, higher intelligence is associated with a decreased ability to delay gratification is fiction, and for the reasons that you guys state. In fact, it is true that the ability to delay gratification is associated with higher intelligence. Bob, did you read this article? Because you gave the exact example out of the article. $1,000 right now or $4,000 in 10 years?
Yeah, that's pretty much... I read the first paragraph. And
yeah, okay. So you read, I figured you read the article. And so those are the kind of choices you give people. And, you know, the more intelligent you are, the more likely you are to pick the $4,000, you know, because it's overall it's a better deal. But you have to wait. Then what the study was looking at was not just, this has been well established previously with psychological studies, but they wanted to see if they could correlate it with any particular parts of the brain. So looked at 103 healthy adults. They, you know, put them through these tasks to see which ones would, you know, delay gratification and which ones do not. Then they looked at their brain function with fMRI study while doing these tasks, and they, you know, found that there was the greatest activation in the anterior prefrontal cortex, which correlated both with higher intelligence and also higher self-control. So they think that there may be a common mechanism there. That brain structure is involved with memory, especially to short-term memory. So they think, well, that, you know, short-term memory may relate to intelligence and also, you know, plays a role in delaying gratification. It's hard to really interpret one study like this because, you know, the interactions with the different pieces of the brain are so complicated. It takes a lot of these kinds of studies to sort of build a picture, but this was interesting. And in any case, there is a large body of evidence which shows that intelligence positively correlates with the ability to delay gratification.
Hooray!
Hooray! Yay. So you guys did a good job.
Most of us. I didn't.
No.
Most of you.
But that's all right.
You almost picked it, Jay.
I know. I mean, I think I said all the things that were accurate about it. It just didn't seem probable to me.
You were thrown off by the bugs.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
You know,
if it was true, I knew it was a bug.
Speaking of animals, you know, I just happened to glance at my email, and we got a really important email just now I'd like to mention. Apparently, on our last podcast, where we discussed flightless birds and their origins, we mentioned the emu as being native to South America, when in fact it is indigenous to Australia. Thank you, Bruce.
I hate
Bruce.
When that happens.
Thank you, Bruce, for sending that in. Bruce Abdul Ralph. He says, good luck. No one gets it right. I hope I did all right.
We're probably still going to get a million of those before it's over with.
Yeah.
It will 5 weeks from now, we'll get correction. You said on this show.
I'm actually going to – my Gmail is now going to filter for the word emu and just send it straight to the trash. I hope nobody writes in offering me a free emu.
A free emu. But, Jay, you do get your consolation prize again this week, which is the privilege of reading the skeptical quote of the week.
Yes, I have a quote. This quote was sent in by listener Rick Woolley, which I appreciate. Anybody sending me quotes, that's great because, you know, it takes me quite a while. And lately I've been trying to find quotes that suit the podcast, and I find that's really difficult. So I really appreciate the quote, Rick.
Rick Woolley kind of sounds like a game show host, doesn't it?
I know. Rick Woolley. This quote is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He was an American essayist, a philosopher, a poet, and leader of the what?
Free world.
The Transcendentalist movement in the early 19th century in the United States.
There was a TM movement then?
Not TM.
No, it was more of a social revolt movement. Anyway, he said, the wise skeptic does not teach doubt, but how to look for the permanent in the mutable and fleeting. Ralph Waldo Emerson!
What does that even mean?
Well, it's just his name,
I mean the
Steve.
Quote.
It doesn't mean anything.
I don't know. I think the wise skeptic does teach doubt. I don't know if I agree with that quote.
Suck it, Ralph.
You don't like my quote this week. That's what you're saying?
What's the point? I'm not sure what he's trying to say.
Instead of teaching doubt, he looks for permanent in the mutable and fleeting.
Oh.
You can't just restate the quote and call that an explanation.
It was Ralph Emerson, man.
Back up
and
your
it has
quote.
The word skeptic in it.
What do you mean back it up? A listener sent this in. This is very important.
I'll blame it on the listener, Jay. Nice.
Well,
hang him out to dry.
Whatever.
Can't wait for next week's listener's quote.
That's okay. It's a tough crowd. Tough crowd. We did finally book our first annual Perry DeAngelis Memorial event this year. Yay. So
where is it?
So here are the details. It will take place on Saturday, October 11th from noon to 3 p.m. This will be at Stage 1 of the Fairfield Theater Company in Fairfield, Connecticut, 70 Sanford Street. This information is on the message board, including directions. We are going to record a live podcast, and we hope to have some guests with us, although I don't have confirmations yet. So as soon as we have confirmations on who that's going to be, we'll let you know. But
they are going to be awesome.
Yes. The five of us will be there recording a live episode at the very least.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll definitely be hanging out afterwards, probably go to dinner and all that stuff as well.
Absolutely.
It's a big hall, so there's plenty of room. Everyone come. It's going to be great.
And what's the significance of having it in Fairfield, Steve?
And we're having it in Fairfield because that is Perry's hometown. That's where Perry lived.
That's where he lived. Many, many,
So
many,
you can
many
make
years.
A pilgrimage.
Yeah, well, we can make a pilgrimage to Perry's old stomping grounds.
You can, yeah, if anyone wants
to. But you have to go there on your knees.
Right, his old scuttling grounds. And also that same weekend, Friday, October 10th at 7 p.m., the New York City Skeptics will celebrate their first anniversary with a lecture by James Randi. This will be at the Caspary Auditorium at Rockefeller University, 1230 York Avenue. At 66th Street in New York City. You can contact the nycskeptics.org for more information. For those of you out of town, you can come in and go to the New York City Skeptics event with James Randi on Friday and then come to see us on Saturday and make it a full skeptical weekend.
It's good stuff.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
The pleasure was all mine.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.